From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is going to be made this coming Saturday at the Strong Museum of Play. Families of children with autism have a chance to attend a conference designed to build relationships with schools, improve emotional wellness, help kids with autism make friends, and so much more. If you are in a family with a child with autism, you know all of the different, not only the challenges, but opportunities and hopefully a growing list of opportunities out there. And the conference is going to be addressing that and a lot more. And there's a lot going on in the local autism community. The U of R has the new Levine Autism Clinic. On South Avenue, there are plans for a new Golisano Autism Center. And at the conference this weekend, national experts are going to be in town giving talks, running workshops, and leading that conference. We're going to talk about those things, including research, why they'd love to see you put your hand up and say, yes, I'd love to get involved in research. That's how so many advancements are made. So let me go ahead and welcome our guests as I tell you that this conversation is part of WXXI's Inclusion Desk, spotlighting issues related to disabilities. The WXXI Inclusion Desk is part of Move to Include, a partnership to encourage thoughtful discussion about issues of inclusion and the differently abled. In studio with us is Susanna Iderola, who is Dr. Iderola is an assistant professor of pediatrics at UR Medicine's Golisano Children's Hospital, and someone who has been trying not to lose sleep in planning the conference that's coming up Saturday. How are you doing?
I've lost several nights of sleep, Evan. Thank you. Yeah, and thank you for having me here today.
You're almost there. And we should tell people the conference is now full up. So that means you're going to be packed on Saturday. Yeah?
Yes, we are planning on being quite packed.
Well, we're going to be talking a lot about what to expect there. Chris Hilton is, first and foremost, a mother and also the finance and operations director for Autism Up. Chris, remind our listeners what Autism Up is.
Autism Up is a not-for-profit. It's a grassroots organization that focuses on improving the lives of individuals impacted by autism, whether it's the individuals themselves or the families and caregivers that support them. We have direct services. We have lots of educational workshops and conferences, but it's really a place to get the education and support that your family needs.
It's great to have you. And we also have Terry Mine, who is with CP Rochester, Happiness House, and Rochester Rehabilitation. Terry, thanks for taking time to come into the program as well today.
Thank you for having me.
A lot going on in the autism community here, isn't there?
There is indeed. It's a very exciting time.
You know, people have been hearing a little bit about the forthcoming Golisano Autism Center, which is going to be on South Avenue. That's right? South Avenue?
Yep, South and Science Parkway.
Okay, and groundbreaking not until the fall of next year, so we've got some time for planning. But Terry, ideally, what's going to be the benefit of the Golisano Autism Center?
So the Golisano Autism Center is a concept that we've been collaborating with Autism Up and Al Siegel Community of Agencies for the last 18 months to 2 years. Chris, does that sound right? To get off the ground. So one of the things that we have heard from families for years is that if they have an individual in their family with autism, they spend a lot of time in the car traveling from place to place to get the supports and services that they need. And that there are a lot of excellent providers of autism services in Rochester, but they're scattered so far apart that it makes it difficult for families. So Mary Boatfield, who's our chief executive officer, came up with the concept of co-locating those services so that families could come to a single site and get services from multiple providers to meet their needs. And it's been a long road, but we're very, very excited about the Golisano gift, and we are well on our way to making it a reality.
And speaking of someone who, again, is not only with Autism Up, but a mom, Chris, can you speak to the value of maybe having a one stop as opposed to many stops?
Well, I think Rochester, we're so blessed because we have this collaborative spirit, and we know that, especially as a parent, you cannot go this route alone. You need other people, whether it's your family or providers or other parents, to come together and really form the best, use the best practices and help the families down this journey. So I think what we're really looking forward to is having that central hub and the continued collaboration and multidisciplinary integration of services, especially partnering with U of R and the Levine Autism Clinic. But this is just a hub. And, you know, for the important thing is to help get these individuals out in the community and really integrated and enjoying the things that so many of us just take for granted.
Coming up on Saturday is the Skirball Family Autism Conference. That's from 8:30 to 2 at the Strong Museum of Play. And again, it's full up with registration. Susanna, that means how many people are coming?
We have close to 200, including national experts from around the country, coming to speak at our conference. We're so excited.
And what's a short kind of definition of the mission of what's coming up on Saturday?
So this was really in response to many conversations that we've had in the community with primarily families of individuals on the autism spectrum, but also providers. And we wanted to come together as a team and really plan a conference together. So this is truly our community conference here in Rochester. We're really excited about it. And we had a committee made of community members to kind of help shape what topics were of interest. And we are here to give some answers to those questions.
Chris, how'd they do on some of the topics? I mean, what to you as a parent is high on the list that you see is going to be covered on Saturday?
Well, these conferences have been going on for a few years now, and every year I walk away with either some new technique or things to use right away with my son, or something that I'm going to look into, more thoroughly. But I really like how family-centered the committee has focused the agenda and being able to break out into different subclasses that they feel would work best for where their child is in the process. The one thing that I think I'm coming to appreciate much more is there's so many transition points as you move through this journey with your child. And whether it's at the Golisano Autism Center or with some of these conference topics, it covers the lifespan. You know, autism is not just a childhood disease. It's a chronic, lifelong issue.
Okay. And Susanna, what's one example of how that's going to be covered at the conference?
So one example is that we have a lifespan of services panel that just overviews for families what is available to you in the community. And, you know, oftentimes at community conferences, especially those that are partnered with schools, tend to focus on school-age kids. But we've actually brought in people specifically to talk about transition to employment, transition to higher education, and life care planning. So we really are trying to be mindful that there are many families who have adults and transition-age adults on the autism spectrum in our community, and we need to speak with them as well.
Listeners, if you have any questions or comments about autism sort of generally, this is a good opportunity this hour with three panelists from sort of different backgrounds with a lot of different expertise who can answer any questions or comments you might want to bring to the discussion about autism in our community. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Susanna, it's one thing to say lifespan of services for a child who gets a diagnosis and goes through different schooling, transitions into adulthood, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering how often, and I'm thinking very specifically of a listener of this program who recently said, I think I'm on the spectrum. I don't know, but I think so. I mean, there's a lot of things that make sense for me as an adult. And we're learning much more about autism with more research and more understanding, obviously more than we did a generation ago. How often do we have adults who basically put their hand up and say, can we talk about me?
Yeah, so I think that's a really important question. And, you know, our diagnostic criteria for autism have changed over the years, most recently in May of 2013. And with that has been kind of an appreciation for the full spectrum of symptoms, including, you know, at the more difficult end, and then people who have stronger skills and might not have been previously identified. So with the changes in the criteria, I think there are now a lot of people who say, oh, okay, now that makes sense to me. Like, I identify with what's being said about this autism spectrum disorder. And so, you know, historically we haven't had a ton of services locally for diagnosing adults, but we are, as a community, trying to change that. And I think that there's going to be some positive changes in that way in the next few years.
And what are the benefits for an adult who might kind of come to that conclusion or at least get some information?
Yeah, I think it depends highly on the person, right? So this might be somebody who's been pretty successful in his or her life without the need for supports and might just want an answer to why I have felt the way that I have felt my whole life. And a lot of people have kind of just expressed the desire to be a part of that community, if that's a community that they identify with. And then certainly there might be individuals who have kind of felt like they have needed additional supports that previously might not have been able to access them, but with an appropriate diagnosis might have new opportunities to receive supports in social interactions or in their jobs or in housing or in other areas.
Before I grab a phone call, let me just ask all of our panelists, when we look at a lifespan of services, how does our community do with transitioning children with autism as they go throughout their teenage years into adulthood and working on that transition? Generally speaking, how are we doing?
Better than a few years ago, but a long way to go, I think. We start planning early in the child's school career in middle school, but a lot of times the planning is inconsistent and the actual targets for end of school career are not clear. But it has gotten better, and I expect that it will continue to improve.
In the medical community, we're fortunate to have had the Complex Care Center open up recently, which serves adults with a variety of needs, including autism spectrum disorder. And the goal was really to facilitate a more warm handoff between pediatric practices and adult practices, and that's been fairly successful. And excellent people who are working at the Complex Care Center, and from what I've heard from families, people are thrilled with the services that are being provided.
Chris, can you tell us a little bit about your experience as a parent in terms of understanding a diagnosis and then, thinking about not just today, this age, this moment, but also planning for transitions in life?
Well, I think that when you find out that your child has autism, it can quite often cover so many different domains, whether it's communication, sensory integration, motor planning, cognitive issues. So there's so much to tackle. And at the same time, you're, whether you know it or not, grieving because your child is now kind of on a different path that could be quite difficult. So that's where I think we're so fortunate to have the Levine Autism Clinic and the experienced team there to help the families get the diagnosis and then make continued recommendations on what the next steps are. But then most families can feel very isolated, and it's organizations like Autism Up that can help them with a very proactive approach to empower the families through education and services to say, you can do this, and how to access the resources in our community. And that's why we love to collaborate with other organizations like Al Siegel and CPR Rochester Happiness House, because there are so many different goals for each family to work on. So it's in every transition point, there are new goals. So whether you're a parent that's now at preschool moving to kindergarten, or where I am, where my son is graduating from high school, moving on to the adult services, you are now faced with different systems that you might have to navigate. And quite often, it's still up to the parent to advocate strongly.
I'm going to jump to the phones in just a moment, but let me just follow up with one question for Chris then, because you mentioned you have a son graduating high school. How much more confident or at least comfortable are you with possible outcomes and paths for him now compared to, say, even 5-10 years ago?
I think that parents' expectations are always evolving and changing. And I think, a lot of the parents that I interact with, we hope that much more will be coming on the horizon to better position our children to achieve their potential, which is what all parents want to do. And so I think, again, with the collaboration in our community, I do see some very bright spots. I just think it's going to take a lot of work, and I think it's really great that the agencies understand that the parent and the self-advocate voice is extremely important in that conversation.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. It's from Kate in Rochester. Go ahead, Kate.
Yes, I was calling to find out how you're addressing the professional community who are dealing with individuals who are on the autism spectrum, and making sure that your services and your deliverables are culturally competent. And how are you being able to build a pipeline of professionals who are able to really accommodate the needs of those individuals?
Do you want to start with the conference?
Susanna, you want to start?
Yeah. Sure. So I can say that, you know, we have been very mindful with our team at the U of R about kind of remaining in constant conversations with members of the community. We have a community consultation program, actually, where you can receive technical assistance if you're a provider who feels like they need a little bit of support in being kind of in inclusion practices around autism spectrum disorder, among other things as well. And actually, one of our research projects that is ongoing right now is the ECHO project, where we have a team of multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary professionals, also including a parent on that team, and providing reach out assistance to providers in the community around issues that they might have identified. So if you're a social work or school psychologist team at a school and you feel like you need a little bit of help in understanding how to better facilitate social skills for individuals and students on the autism spectrum, then you can participate in an ECHO and we can give you some of that information. So we're trying to find ways to reach providers who we haven't reached before, to reach out into rural communities who might not be benefiting from the wealth of resources that we have available in the Rochester area, and remain in contact with our providers in that way.
Kate, you want to follow up there?
Yeah, just a little bit about how you create a professional pipeline of individuals who can actually address some of these rather than just having a referral basis.
So, Kate, this is Terry. We are moving from concept to actual program development for the new Golisano Autism Center, and we have a committee that will be looking at not just only supports and services for individuals and families, but professionals and what those supports will look like ongoing. We have a couple unique positions that are going to be shared by everybody who is within the providing services within or being referred out to from that center, where there are some shared resources around approaches and philosophical thoughts around quality services and what those quality services might look like. As far as cultural competencies, that certainly is an issue that we're discussing and inviting people to the table who can ensure that we meet all the community needs. And so we're just beginning the process. And hopefully the next year and a half will be a very exciting time to round out what we have to offer.
I think, you know, Kate's question on just building that pipeline of professionals who are competent in this field is important. I remember a parent a couple of years ago on this program basically imploring me, saying, please stay on the schools. Please stay on. Just make sure, you know, had some rough experience. And this is not throwing local public schools under the bus at all. Not at all. It's just a parent saying, had some really surprisingly tough moments with a child who has autism in schools, and saying, you know, was a little surprised at how certain things were handled and wants to see some progress and wants to see that pipeline. So there are professionals in a lot of different places in our community who can deal with it. So, you know, Chris, how do you feel, especially as a parent, about that issue?
Well, you know, the professionals that are helping individuals with autism and working with the families, they carry such a heavy burden. I know my son would not be where he is without all the dedicated professionals that we have dealt with, whether it's a medical professional or a school professional or in the community-based organizations. You know, they really need more resources. There's so many children in our community, whether they're diagnosed with autism or have related issues, that the schools really have a lot to contend with. And so I think having more time to do more curriculum planning, more professional development. I know Autism Up, we tend to have a fall conference where we bring in national speakers, where professionals are usually the majority of the population. But they want more time to practice what they've learned. So I think if, you know, those out there that could respond to, you know, providing more support to the professionals that are working so diligently, I think that would be a huge and very smart investment.
All right, let me get back to the phones. In Williamson, this is Steve next. Go ahead, Steve.
Good morning, or good afternoon.
Yeah.
I have a question, and I can take the answer off the phone anyways. I've heard a lot of tie-ins between autism and childhood inoculations. I wonder if there's any truth to that, any tie-in, or just plain false. I appreciate your program, and thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Susanna, I'm going to kick this to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I can speak to that. So many people have probably heard that the original report that was tying vaccinations to the development of autism over time was made of fabricated data. So the data were all false. And the doctor who has since had his medical license revoked who made up those data had a conflict of interest with the pharmaceutical companies and had a financial interest in making sure that people did not go and get their vaccinations. Since then, we've had dozens of studies that have completely debunked the myth and the link between autism and vaccines. Those of us who work in the profession all get our children vaccinated on the recommended schedule. And so I appreciate you asking the question because I think that it still is a concern for a lot of people. And we will definitely take any opportunity to say that there is no link between vaccines and autism.
Sure. And I would just say to callers like Steve, you know, I mean, Steve may be a very smart, caring guy, but he's a busy person. He doesn't study this issue in a day-to-day basis and may have heard a story here and there. So that's what it sounds like there. He just wanted information. And I think I appreciate you in a very calm manner just saying, just a reminder, this has been asked and answered for years, but that's fine, and we'll keep doing that. Do you anticipate a time when you won't have to do that again?
You know, I have to say, again, to kind of Steve's credit, that we in the medical community maybe have not done as good a PR job of kind of advertising the research that's come out about the link, the lack of the link between vaccines and autism. So, you know, I do appreciate people continuing to have this conversation because it allows us to kind of reiterate the message in a way that we might not otherwise. And I'm assuming that we'll probably reach some people who hadn't heard about this before. So thank you again.
And I think the name of the person who first kind of spread that false information was Andrew Wakefield.
That's correct.
So, Steve, go ahead and Google Andrew Wakefield, and you will put him in the category of amazing to still get paid work in 2017. Oliver North, Andrew Wakefield, you can be wrong about anything and still. But it has been asked and answered. And, Steve, thanks for bringing that up, and hopefully that's the last we hear about that. Let's turn, though, to a little bit about research, ongoing research. And I want to ask Susanna Iderola, who is an assistant professor of pediatrics at UR Medicine Scalasano Children's Hospital, you know, why you want the community to, you know, not only to be aware of research, but to be aware of how, you know, so they can impact or what they can do.
So, you know, most of us who are doing research in developmental behavioral pediatrics, we're also providers, right? So we're talking to families. We're sitting at tables with them in the community. We're talking with them in clinic. We're meeting with them in the community. And we hear a lot of the same questions. And so we develop research programs to help answer the questions that you as our community are asking us. And research, medical research, behavioral research, it has an enormous potential to create impact in the real day-to-day functioning for individuals on the autism spectrum and their families. And we really have prided ourselves on a very practical line of research that can, you know, affect, give you real world skills to addressing the challenges that you might face.
When it comes to the need for people to participate in research, you know, what is the value to you to seeing new results and seeing new research out there?
We cannot make advancements in autism research without research participants. It is impossible. And we are so grateful for the Rochester community who have generously donated their time over and over again to our various research projects. We try to give you something back in return, whether it's services through the study or information or, you know, just the knowledge that you're doing something for the greater autism community at large. So I'm thanking you, and I'm asking you to spread the word to everybody you know to please check out our research page at the University of Rochester Medical Center. You could Google U of R Autism Research, learn about all the different programs that we have going on right now for kids from 2 to adulthood, and learn about how you can be part of this journey with us.
Susanna, what are you most either excited about or interested in when it comes to ongoing research right now?
So I think there's a couple things to say about that. You know, we've really tried to partner more with the community over time. And again, like, we have to give props to our amazing community members who are part of our research teams. And so the community involvement in the research projects has helped us kind of deploy practices that we know are helpful and get them to more people, which is a really important aspect of work that's being done in this area and in rural communities as well. And then I would also have to say, you know, the translational research that's looking at biology and genetics and things like that, and how can we create research programs that kind of address the biological underpinnings of ASD as best as we know them right now, has enormous potential for advancing the field.
Is the media not doing a very good job covering research? And I'm not asking this in a way that I don't want you to coddle us here. I want to ask very honestly, because sometimes we see initial results, or you know, a study that, just understanding what a study is and what sample sizes are, and you know, what is verifiable, what's not, that kind of stuff, is not something that a lot of journalists are trained in, myself included. And we want to be excited about results that are new. Sometimes we maybe, you know, sort of ring the bell a little too strongly about early research, and sometimes we may miss a development that's really important and not give it the appropriate attention. Could the media do a better job with this?
Well, I think we all could do a better job with that. And
You're so kind.
I'm avoiding eye contact with our PR person who has to be in the room with me and is looking at me
I should bring him to the mic and ask him if the media is doing a good job.
Yeah, no, what I think is I'm pleased to see that I think through the variety of outlets via social media and other like more expansive ways of getting research results out through the community, you're seeing kind of more of a practical translation from what's happening in research to like how does this actually affect us on a day-to-day basis. Sample sizes are not sexy. Like power analyses are not that sexy. So we have to figure out a way to tell the story in a way that's meaningful for people. And I think we're getting better, but I think we all could be doing a better job at that.
Well, let me ask Chris Hilton if you agree. I mean, and especially because, you know, you're probably thinking something new could be really informational, really powerful to understand or unlock some secrets. And, you know, so I wonder how you feel about what you see with research and then how you see it sort of communicated.
Well, I feel very strongly about research. As a finance person, too, I know the power of data. And unless we have the data, we can't really make changes. My son participates in the U of R Autism Treatment Network Registry, which that's another aspect of what's going on here in Rochester. But yes, I mean, I totally agree with everything Susanna said, we feel that it's our way to give back for Peyton to participate in the research. I think working more collaboratively within the community will encourage more participation. I think these conferences, when families see how their support in these studies pays off, I think that'll encourage more people. So, yeah, we're not going to get the changes that I think all the families are looking for unless we do more of this research and participate any way we can.
An email from a listener named Jill. She just wants to know if your panel thinks we will ever be able to say exactly what causes autism. Susanna?
Oh, that's a really tough question. I think we've made huge advancements in our understanding of autism spectrum disorder, you know, even across the last 15 or 20 years. We are working on identifying what are the biological causes of autism. I can't say how far away we are from fully understanding this condition, but we're never going to find the answer if people don't sign up for research. So I got to bring it back home.
You're very consistent. Is it potentially too complex to say? Is it the kind of thing where we could say, kind of like migraine? You know, there's going to be different triggers or different reasons for it. It's not maybe going to be just one thing. It's complex, but we'll get better at identifying, you know, certain underlying causes as opposed to one single thing?
Right, so that's exactly right. So one of the complicated things about autism spectrum disorder is that there are many candidate genes that we're examining as potential cause, and it's also a combination between kind of genetics and then environment, not necessarily like what's around us after you're born, but kind of what's happening during pregnancy and exposures in that way. And so, we have identified things that might be potential triggers for kind of if you're already susceptible maybe to developing autism, like what else might happen during pregnancy that would make that express itself when you are born. But because there are so many different factors that might contribute, that is one of the things that's driving the fact that we're a long ways away.
Okay, so if you want to participate in research one more time, where do you go? How do you find it?
Just Google University of Rochester Autism Research. It will take you to our page.
Okay, and you can get the information you need, and Susanna Iderola is going to be so appreciative if that's the case. She's an assistant professor of pediatrics at UR Medicine's Golisano Children's Hospital and has been helping to organize the Skirball Family Autism Conference, which happens this Saturday at the Strong Museum of Play. We also have Terry Mine from CP Rochester Happiness House and Rochester Rehabilitation, and Chris Hilton, who is the Finance and Operations Director for Autism Up and a parent. We'll take our only break of the hour. If you want to call the program with comments or questions on autism, it's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we are covering live national coverage of former FBI Director James Comey's testimony. That starts around 10 a.m. We expect it to run at least until 1 p.m., and you will hear it in its entirety. So that'll take up the first hour of what is normally Connections at noon. And then in our second hour, news that NASA wants to fly close to the sun. How? We'll discuss it Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll get back to your phone calls in just a moment. And we want to tell you about the Skirball Family Autism Conference, which is coming up on Saturday. That's this Saturday from 8:30 to 2 at the Strong Museum of Play. It is now filled up with full registration experts coming in talking about a wide range of issues. And I know that Chris Hilton wanted to make a point about the Autism Treatment Network and the impact it's having not only on the conference but on the community. Tell me about that.
Well, the U of R is one of, I believe, 13 sites across North America of other major universities that are involved in the research and interventions involved with autism, which is so important because there's so much collaboration between these organizations or these universities to ensure that, you know, no one's duplicating efforts. They're trying to make sure that they're covering a lot of the areas that need study, and then how to bring those best practices back to the communities that they're in and working with families and other providers in the community to make that happen. So it's a really important link that we have here in Rochester.
The Autism Treatment Network is an excellent example of translating research into practical, you know, real-world applications. Even though it's driven by research, really the overarching goal of the Autism Treatment Network is to establish a standard of care for individuals with autism spectrum disorder and their families, and to create a quality medical home that integrates multidisciplinary practice and evidence-based practice and really help guide families in making, you know, decisions that they're comfortable with and that we in the research community feel like are supported by evidence.
Another aspect that Autism Up a few years ago created a family navigator position that is in the Levine Autism Clinic and is really a wonderful resource for families that are either new to the diagnosis or there for follow-up care, just giving them the emotional support that they might need, directing them more quickly to resources. And what makes this position more unique is because of the relationship with the Autism Treatment Network, that this is a growing area of interest where all these universities are having family navigator positions on site. And so they're sharing experiences and making the most of how this will translate. We're very lucky in that Lisa Latin is our family navigator here, and as a parent, she has a unique perspective that she brings so nicely to the families. But this is also going to translate to the new Golisano Autism Center and making that bridge from the medical side into the more intervention and practical side. So I don't know if Terry.
Sure. So the educational services, the community-based supports and services, employment, housing, all of those options that are available to individuals. There will be a single family navigator for the site that is linked to every provider, hopefully every provider in the region, but certainly every provider that is associated with the Golisano Autism Center. And so families she or he will help them through the whole process of not only these are the opportunities for you, but a single intake, a warm handoff for every opportunity. So that is one of the shared positions. The other is around that leader of the center who has the background and expertise in autism to be able to help every provider. So one of the things that is true is that some very small providers can't afford that type of assistance, and many of us rely on the U of R for their expertise and get assistance from them. But the center will have an individual who can help not only families but providers improve their services.
All right, let me get back to our phone calls, and we'll go down to Ithaca. This is Linda next. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi. I was just listening to conversation, and I'm sorry, but I've read 4 entire books on vaccines, and I've worked with kids with autism. And I've read Andy Wakefield's book, and I've read Evidence of Harm by David Kirby, and DPT, Shot in the Dark by Barbara Lowe Fisher, and Vaccine Epidemic. And there's so much more to it than a one-sided story. And I'm sorry, just always saying that Andy Wakefield was discredited. If you'd read his book, you would know that he didn't come out and say the vaccines cause autism.
Linda, are you aware of how thoroughly discredited he's been and all of the follow-up and all of the investigation?
Yes.
You're aware?
Yes, I'm very aware.
Okay, so why are you hanging on to his discredited work?
Because I've done more research than that.
Are you a professional researcher?
No, I've read a lot of it, though. I've worked with kids with autism. If there is no problem with vaccines, why is there a vaccine court paying damages?
Okay, so listen, Linda, you've got a professional here in Susanna Iderola.
Yeah, I know, and the IAP is one of the biggest promoters of vaccines, and they will never admit harm.
Okay, so just help me understand something, though, Linda. I do want to try to understand your position. So help me understand. Do you think vaccines at all do good? Are any vaccines good in your mind?
Some, yes.
Okay. How do you distinguish between what's good and what's not?
I think that I am not against the science of vaccines. I'm against the misuse of them. I'm against the money that's behind them. I'm against the schedule that went from less than 30 to 90 in a childhood. Right? I think that they are controlled more by money than they are by common sense. I'm against some of the ingredients in them. The suppression of information, especially the CDC, which has been dreadful.
No, I mean, so the ingredients, this is one where a lot of people who don't have medical training, me included, get confused. You know, you see certain ingredients and you can pick out different ingredients. And you go, wow, that doesn't sound good or that's scary to me, you know. But we're not trained in sort of the levels or the utility of an ingredient that leads to different efficacy and different effects. And so, listen, as a parent, I had similar questions. I'm going, well, this ingredient and this and this. And what I did was I took it directly to experts who work with that, and they sort of laid it out and explained it. Are there individual ingredients that scare you that we can kind of work through?
You got aluminum. And, of course, the mercury. And even the ones that don't, that say they don't have mercury, do have mercury. And if you add up the mercury in them, the ones that what the kids will get, it's even more than the EPA allows in our water.
Okay.
There really is more to it than just, you know, how much mercury. I mean, you've got Hannah Pauling was the first child in the vaccine court. When the doctor decided to catch up with vaccines, he turned her into a vegetable, and there she is today.
Okay.
And she was compensated by the court, which apparently does believe that they caused damage or they wouldn't have set up the court.
All right, so Linda, I've got to stop you there because what I don't want to do is spend too much time spreading information that could do damage to our community. And unfortunately, what you're talking about could do that. But I do want to just ask Susanna Iderola, just, you know, she brought up mercury, she, as an example, aluminum. Those are common concerns that people raise. What would you say to that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding about what actually has been included in vaccines. So, for example, the mercury concern was driven by a mercury preservative called thimerosal, which used to be included in vaccines to help preserve them so that you could give them in multiple doses instead of single doses. And even though that has not been directly tied to any autism or other conditions, it has been since removed. Decades. It's been about a decade since it was removed from all vaccinations. But I think that the fear and the concern behind that, you know, that story still remains. And so, you know, I think if you're concerned about these things, it's really important to talk them through with medical providers because this clearly is a heated issue for you and it's an emotional issue for you. And you should have the space to be able to discuss that with people who can adequately address your concerns, which is probably more than I'm afraid I can do on a show today.
Yeah. And Linda, I will just say, you know, I mean, I know you're calling in good faith and have genuine concerns and I respect and appreciate that. My concern, though, is just I don't want the program to get bogged down with information that's been discredited, that has done damage. You know, when we see mass, lack of vaccination, communities growing with children not vaccinated, we've seen in recent years some of the consequences of that. And I know you're concerned about money. I would also urge you to kind of just understand that there's a lot of money to be made on all sides of this, Andy Wakefield among them. So vaccines are not generally a big engine of finance for or profit, but they have done remarkable things for our world. And I appreciate the phone call. Thank you, Linda. Let's get away from that as best we can. I know Susanna's got to get out of here in just a few minutes. So why don't I just kick at you with this? What else is coming up in the conference that we haven't even had a chance to talk about? Because there's all these bullet points and things that I wanted to talk about, which is great. But what else is coming up that's going to be discussed on Saturday that you think is exciting or valuable?
Yeah, I think the conference is a really exciting opportunity, like Chris mentioned, we've done in the past, to kind of merge the practical questions that our community are bringing up around things like, how do you build a better relationship with your school and improve communication there? How do you help your child make friends? What do you do if you think that your child might have some emotional concerns in addition to autism spectrum disorder? What do I do when my child's a teenager and about to transition out into the real world? So those kinds of practical questions that are really important, and then bridging that together with the research that's been done here and at other institutions. They're bringing in speakers who have very long, extensive lines of research in these areas. And so we're going to hopefully help the media a little bit and translate some of those research findings into practical strategies that our families can walk away with.
When we see subject headings like this, for example, helping kids make friends, this is, I think, a great one. We've had such interesting conversations with adults with autism on this program, sharing their experiences and their sort of journey of self-discovery, their interpersonal relationships. You know, Chris, how do you view this kind of topic heading on kids making friends and the importance of understanding and sort of different approaches here?
Well, obviously, that's what we all want, is to make friends and have things to look forward to doing. And sometimes it can be harder when you have autism, because your communication may be challenging, and continuing the interactions, having the social skills that allow you to make and keep friends. So I think that's where I know Peyton has participated at Autism Up. We have a lot of especially programming that starts younger but moves into teens, where they get out in the community and have things to do together. So that is always a lot easier to have some shared experiences. But you need practice, and you need trained professionals to guide and nurture those interactions, which is what we're trying to do at Autism Up. And I know that, this is a lifelong issue. So I know that even adults will struggle with it. So having more time to get out in the community with each other, I think, is really helpful.
And Susanna Iderola's got a split because your schedule is packed this week. So thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Evan.
We're going to let you get out of here, and we'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure. But thank you for sharing your expertise and your time with us and our listeners this afternoon.
Thank you, and thank you, Chris and Terry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So she's out of here. Chris and Terry hanging with me for another 8 minutes or so. Susanna Iderola is Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at UR Medicine's Golisano Children's Hospital, and among many other things has been working so hard on the Family Autism Conference that's coming up this coming Saturday. By the way, Chris, I think of a conversation I had with a colleague of mine in a past work life, who was one of the adults in this category, who at the age of 26 said, I think I should talk to somebody about this. And then came back and said, they told me I have Asperger's. And I said, well, that's great. Knowledge is a good thing. I think that's, and later he said to me, at times I struggled with you because occasionally you can be sarcastic. And I said, no, and I was being sarcastic. And he said, I don't really recognize sarcasm. And I said, oh, okay. For me, it was enlightening as a colleague and a friend. And then I kind of felt terrible looking back at that. But that knowledge of just a diagnosis and that how that interaction can impact was enormous, because it was holding up our relationship or occasionally leading friction when I could have done such a better job if I simply understood something. And I wonder how often that happens.
Well, probably more than we would all like, but I think you raise a really good point in that this is why it's so important to get more integration in the community. And I know the schools, the one thing they are doing so well that they did better than when I was in school is, Peyton is part of the community. He gets to interact with so many different types of kids, and they get to know him and appreciate some of the differences. And I think you know, if I can just give a shout out to Special Olympics and their unified sports program. Peyton participated in the basketball program that they just had, where it's a co-ed, fully integrated program at the high school level. They go in the community, they play real games with other schools, they ride the bus, they wear jerseys, they, you know, have a very typical sports experience that if that program was not there, Peyton would never have that experience and never have the chance to experience things with the other kids in the community at Fairport and other places. So I think it's more education that the community has in supporting those that just may have just a different social profile and how they share it. But, you know, if, you know, so many people say how much Peyton brightens their day. And, you know, I think that's true of so many, all the individuals with autism. They just need the chance to get out there and interact and share their strengths and interests.
Let me get a comment from a listener and kind of turn back to Terry Mayan, who Terry said earlier, you know, this community has come a long way, but we have a long way to go when it comes to service providing. And Caitlin said, can you have your guests address language of service provision? What about ASL, Spanish, et cetera? I mean, is that just part of the list of bringing, you know, more under the umbrella of offering, you know, better and more comprehensive services?
Yeah. So we have really been working hard on cultural competency and trying to employ a variety of staff that can meet the entire community's needs, and that there's still more work to be done there as well. But I just want to go off what Chris was just talking about her son having his life enriched by the people he interacts with, but also enriching the lives of the people that he is interacting with. And CP Rochester and Happiness House have had fully integrated preschools for 40 years, so we know it works. And for most people, when they come to visit our schools, unless a child has a physical disability that's visually detectable, but you can't determine which children in the classroom are there because they have different abilities or which children are typically developing. And so, and they grow so much as preschoolers socially and have an opportunity to take that on to school. And so if they can get it right at 3 and 4, we should be able to get it right for our entire lifetime. And so I think, you know, there's great value in what Chris had to say.
Yeah, you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. And actually, full disclosure, Peyton participated in the EI and preschool programs when he was that age at CP Rochester, and they were excellent and really got him on the right path. I also want to say how, you know, social skills and the development of that is not only important in the friendships, but it's also very important in the vocational experiences that this population will be able to obtain and keep. So it's definitely something that we all need to keep encouraging and supporting more programming around that.
I have two separate messages from doctors in this community, private messages through social media, just urging me to remind listeners that while it's valuable to have dialogue with people about their understanding on medical issues, it's important to stress that what we heard from Linda, who called earlier, was not accurate medically. I thought I did so, but I just want to stress that again. And I appreciate her calling. But again, we have no evidence that vaccines cause autism. In fact, we have evidence that vaccines are awesome. One more quick phone call. We've got to keep it tight. And this is Robert in Greece. Go ahead, Robert.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I thought I would mention, even though I guess you're mostly talking about families and children, for adults with autism, specifically Asperger's, there's a square pegs for adults. So you have to be like age 18 and up. But the square pegs adult Asperger's group, so if you're age 18 and up, it's the goal is for, oh, and they do alternating schedules. So they'll have a serious, like people talk about their problems, but then they'll also have a social meeting. So they'll alternate every 2 months with having a social get together with pizza and then a more, you know, formalized where people discuss their problems and issues. But they've been doing that for at least 10 years, I think over 10 years of having this square pegs group meet on a monthly basis for adults with Asperger's.
It's called Square Pegs.
Yes. Oh, and they meet at, I should tell you the location, it's Alexander and Park Avenue, the nursing home there is, now I'm drawing a temporary blank on the name of the nursing home, but it's right
okay.
at the corner of Park and Alexander. They meet there in the meeting rooms of the nursing home, and then the other months, where for the social gatherings, they'll usually pick a restaurant.
All right, well, Robert, thank you. Square Pegs is what it's called. Just another example of, sort of the organic and sometimes grassroots support that's out there in the community. We've learned so much this hour. Chris Hilton from Autism Up, some 20 seconds, some final thoughts you want to leave listeners with and what kind of stands out to you?
I just think that, to really help those that are impacted with autism, it's a village approach, and we can all work together to make lives better in our community for those.
Well, thank you, and thanks for what you're doing. Terry Mine from CP Rochester Happiness House and Rochester Rehabilitation. Nice having you. Thanks for taking the time to come in. And I know as we go forward here, you heard from Terry earlier, it's still fall 2018 for groundbreaking on the Golisano Autism Center that'll be on South Avenue in Rochester. But you heard from Terry especially about how that's going to bring so much together. And so we'll have a lot to talk about going forward. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
It's great to have you here. Our thanks as well to Susanna Iderola from UR Medicine's Golisano Children's Hospital. Best of luck on the conference on Saturday. Thanks for all the interaction today. And thanks to Kat Schwarz Engineering today and Megan Mack Producing. I'm Evan Dawson, and I'm merely the host. And I'm right back with you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.